Welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On the show this week, a rising British star, actress Romola Gary, joins me to talk about her role in Stephen Poliakoff's Glorious 39 and the travails of a young actress in the British film industry. And as the London Children's Film Festival gets underway, we'll be meeting 13-year-old film festival ambassador Jubir Hussain. He'll be joined by programmer Robert Ryder to tell us about a festival that's, you know, for kids. And Zam Brooks and I will be reviewing the Coen brothers' A Serious Man, you know, for Jews. Matt Damon is also in Steven Soderbergh's The Informant, and the teens who like to bite are in New Moon. Yes, it's fantastic. It's Film Weekly.
I was just thinking about Mr. Balcombe. What does he do, Papa?
He works at the Home Office, doing various things.
Oh, he's in the Secret Service, of course, it's obvious.
Is he? Would he have taken an interest in Hector?
Very possibly. But I don't think he can have bumped him off, Anne.
Bumped him off? Oh, Anne, your love of the dramatic.
No, I didn't mean that, of course.
Mind you, he's rather spooky.
He seems a little odd, I admit, but he shares my love of fishing.
Bill Nighy and Romola Gary there in a scene from Stephen Poliakoff's film Glorious 39, a superly stylish thriller set in 1939 as Britain moves closer to war with Adolf Hitler. To tell me more about the film, but not too much, I'm sure, I'm joined by Romola Gary. Welcome to Film Weekly, Romola. Lovely to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on your performance in Glorious 39, which I think, if I'm right, you're sort of in every scene.
I'd try.
Is that why you took it?
Hold I think on, I should be in this scene.
I mean is that it's a kind of a tour de force. It's kind of a hell of a lot of work, it looks like, being in a film, like carrying a film like that.
Yeah, I think Stephen writes really fantastic roles for women, always does. And so you sort of know when you're working for him that it's he never writes any kind of, sort of trite roles. So it's always a sort of challenge. But in this film, because the subject matter and the history is quite complicated and probably unknown to people, the character that I play effectively introduces people to a lot of that. And that was always a concern to remember that you're kind of taking the audience with you on the journey.
So just briefly, explain the film to me and explain your character of Anne.
So, yeah, it's a thriller, as you said. It's set in the summer before World War II was declared. It's really a conspiracy thriller based on true events where members of Chamberlain's government and the Secret Service had a plan in action to basically try and keep Britain out of World War II. They were not only appeasers, but also taken further than that. They really vehemently believed that Britain would lose and that the only solution was to make a deal with Hitler and Britain would have become a Vichy state. And that was a very close run thing. I don't think people realise how close that situation.
I certainly didn't realise it until I was watching the film. Yeah. What I liked about Stephen Poliakoff's film and what I like about his work in general is that you're never quite sure if it is completely true or not. And I quite like the fact that some people kind of get annoyed that he doesn't kind of quite adhere to the historical fact. But I don't want films to adhere to historical fact because they never do and they can't.
No.
So you want to play with it. So it is. Were you aware of the kind of ludic nature, the playfulness that was going to be involved with this? Because you're going back through many layers of work.
Absolutely. I mean, as you say, like, I'm a big fan of his work. And if you look at the kind of canon of his work, you constantly see. I mean, it's not only that he doesn't adhere to the truth, it's that he really consciously plays with the truth. And the truth is something that is a theme throughout his work. And when you look at Shooting the Past, or if you look at The Lost Prince, then you're looking at stories about the nature of myth and what's true and what isn't so important. What he wants you to be aware of is that you don't know, and it's an ambiguous thing. And so, yeah, I knew that was going to be the case.
I mean, it reminded me that at the start of the go-between, for example, Happy Hartley's The Past is a Foreign Country, they do things differently there. That seems to be kind of obtained for most of Stephen Poliakoff's work as well. In fact, Christopher Lee, the character at the start of this, sort of says the past is a dangerous place to go.
Yeah, I think the go-between was a big influence on this film. I know that Stephen Austin also really references Rosemary's Baby, which again is another film, and Polanski is someone who else is, I think, is quite interested in the kind of ambiguous nature of the truth.
Did you know this about Stephen Poliakoff's work in in, or did you kind of, you know, gen up on it when you got offered the part, or were you just happened to be sort of an expert in his stuff anyway?
Well, still not an expert, because he has an awful lot of work to get through. I mean, I haven't seen everything he's ever done, because it would take a lot of time, but Shooting the Past came out when I was, I think, probably at quite a formative age in terms of my awareness of culture, and it dealt with a photographic agency, and my family had originally come to this country as my great-grandfather ran a picture agency called Keystone Press, Bert Gary. So we all sat down as a family to watch it because my parents were very, very interested in the subject matter. And I think that was a really big moment for me. I mean, it was not only about a kind of family experiencing something together, but also me really seeing, I think, something of the most unsettling piece of drama I'd ever seen.
It's Tim Spall and Lindsay Duncan.
Exactly, yeah, Matthew McFadden. And yeah, it's an amazing, amazing piece of work.
And it's all about what you can do visually with pictures and photographs. Yeah. And stuff. It had the same effect on me.
Exactly. Oh, good. I'm so glad you like it, because I think it's amazing.
I'm probably a bit older, though, but it was a remarkable piece of work and played with family memories, and which is what... Exactly what's happening again in Glorious 39, and I thought rather nicely, because it also plays with your iconography a bit, because I was slightly reminded of the first time I saw you, which was like in I Capture the Castle, that kind of very sort of similar British kind of thing going on.
It was weird, because I haven't really met anyone who's had a similar sort of experience, but I Capture the Castle and Glorious 39 are like kind of... Glorious 39 is like the twisted sister of I Capture the Castle, which they're both stories very concerned with young women in the 30s who have... not sort of fixations, I wouldn't take it that far, but really admire their fathers, and it's about the story's sort of the father's fall from grace. I mean, I Capture the Castle is very much a personal story. Glorious 39 is more of a kind of political narrative, but they are very oddly similar, and obviously I'm playing them with both the same actor, so it's kind of strange.
Yeah, so what is it with you and Bill?
Right. Yes, the frisson of tension. I think that Bill could... very believably be my father. I think we have a similar sort of...
He'd be a great dad, wouldn't he?
Yeah, I'm sure he would.
I'm not saying that yours isn't good enough either, but I mean...
Yeah, no, Dad, you do a great job. But no, and also I think Bill and I both maybe complement each other in terms of our acting style, and that, you know, Bill's quite a kind of big actor in some ways, and I mean that in the best way, in that he, you know, really commits. And I think I have the same kind of tendency, so I wonder whether maybe we sort of... When you're doing a similar kind of acting, you're sort of gelling on screen.
Let's talk about your acting, your style, because you're sort of unusual, actually, because I think you're quite a big actress.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a lot of young actresses, and I think particularly in Hollywood, who kind of downplay, kind of do very minimal, and you don't do that, which I think is unusual in modern screen. Is that something you're aware of? Is it a style you've adopted, or is that just the way you are? You're quite
expansive. I'm quite a theatrical person. Yeah, no, I think I am kind of quite a theatrical person, and I think what happens is, you know, you go up for work, and it just so happens that you have a natural ability to play certain characters that maybe require a bit more theatricality, and so that has, and then that obviously ends up kind of accentuating a natural habit that you might already have. So, you know, then obviously, you know, you have to do a film like Atonement where you can't do anything at all, and Joe Wright was kind of taping my arms to my side and was like, don't do anything at all, and I'm there going, but how will they know what I'm thinking? But yeah, so you have to try and work to get the opposite,
because you have very different kind of people that you work for. So Stephen Polyakov, we were talking about you when you weren't here with Francois Ozon for Angel, which I thought was fabulous. I thought you were wonderful
it
again. I'm not just saying that because you're here, but you can get the tapes. We were talking about you and thought you were wonderful.
I'm so pleased, because it was suddenly divided.
Everyone hated it. I don't know why they hated it. I was like, this is great.
Yeah, I think it's a very acquired taste thing.
You were very lovely in Inside I'm Dancing as well with James McAvoy.
That's the one contemporary sort of one.
I've seen you. You were wearing normal clothes.
I was wearing jeans.
Yes. Yeah. And you were very good. I mean, there was what's it called? Dirty Dancing 2. I saw it on an aeroplane once. I thought, you know what, I better do, because I did avoided it. I thought, I don't want to see young
It's much Romana. Better on a small screen far away.
35,000 feet, I still wanted to jump out the exits.
Yeah. Imagine what it's like when I see it. Yeah.
It's probably your highest grossing film, though, Romana.
Oh, no, that's the thing. I mean, like, you know, the very sort of few forays that I go to sort of scuttle into America and then scuttle home is that the only thing I've done that anybody there has any awareness of at all is Dirty Dancing 2, which is probably the worst film ever made. So, you know, I'm like there going, trying to be sort of terribly earnest and pretentious about Polyakov and Francois Ozon and working for the RSC and you know, and people are like, what was it like dancing with Patrick Swayze?
So hot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It is interesting because I do think of you such a British actress, and I always look at the kind of the arc of a British actress's career, and you were talking about what the possibilities available in British film. Do you think they are limiting, or do you have to kind of work on your versatility and kind of go push yourself up for parts that people won't necessarily cast you in?
Yeah, I mean, I think really it is about how what you want out of your career, and you know, if you look at the actresses that have gone to America and made very successful careers out of there, they have spent time there. You have to commit to it. I mean, Hollywood, to a certain extent, I feel like can give you a great career, but you have to want it, and they can sniff it if you don't. They can smell it in the room if you're like, I kind of want it on my own terms. That doesn't go down well. So, I mean, when I look at the actors in this country that whose careers I would really love to emulate, you know, I'm looking at actors that work in lots of different mediums. They work in television, they work in, you know, like you've got Gina McKee or, you know, Emily Watson, and, you know, and so I think it is possible to stay in this country and have a really fulfilling career.
Yeah, no, I think it totally is, but you have to be prepared to kind of, because Gina McKee, one of the greats, I think,
exactly,
but not sort of acknowledged, universally acknowledged as such.
But I think that that's okay. I mean, you know, I know that the satisfaction, I love my job, and the satisfaction that I get out of it is as much as I possibly can, although I am obviously human and flawed, based on how much pleasure I get out of it. And you know, that's why I think, to a certain extent, I really admire actresses who maybe, you know, aren't on the cover of Vanity Fair, but I think are as good as you can
you
be.
You were in the film of Vanity Fair.
Exactly.
How's about that?
That's even better.
Yes, yeah. I know. Where can we see you next? Are you looking? Because I know you like theatre as well.
I do. I'm actually going into the theatre. I'm going to do a production of Chekhov's The Three Sisters. So I shall be draped in black and howling. Masha.
Good.
So if you see me wandering in West London, dressed in black, looking for Moscow, then you'll know that's why. But no, I mean, obviously film is sort of the great chunk of my career, and I love doing theatre, but you know, I'm a big cinephile, and so I'm hoping to work with many, many more great British directors if I get the chance.
Yeah, well, they listen to this, so show you.
Oh, gosh, right. Please. Yes.
Employ moi.
Yeah.
Congratulations on Glorious 39. I wish you the best of luck with The Three Sisters. I hope you find Moscow.
Thanks very much. Me too.
Glorious 39, starring Romola Gary, Bill Nighy, David Tennant, Julie Christie, Christopher Lee and Eddie Redmayne, among many others, goes on general release here in the UK from Friday, the 20th of November. And now for the legendary review section of Film Weekly. Zan Brooks is back, Guardian critic at large. Welcome, Zan.
Thank you.
This week, let's have a look at the Coen brothers' A Serious Man. We'll look at Steven Soderbergh's The Informant, and then we'll move on to New Moon, which is the second part of the Twilight saga, in case you're over the age of 20 and have no idea what we're talking about. But let's start with the Coens. We had them on the show last week. Their new film, A Serious Man, mines a seam they've never done before. Their own Bar Mitzvah's 1967, the Midwest, Minnesota. They've been on that ground, of course, in Fargo, but they've never kind of admitted to being as Jewish as this. Here, we get a scene with Larry Gopnik being told by his wife that she wants a get-out clause, or just a get.
Where do I sleep?
What?
Arthur's on the couch.
Look, Cy feels that we should...
Esther is barely cold.
Esther died 3 years ago, and it was a loveless marriage. Cy wants a get.
A what?
A ritual divorce. He says it's very important. Without a get, I'm an aguna.
A what? What are you talking about?
You always act
Michael
so
Stuhlbarg as Larry Gopnik there, the middle-aged professor whose son's bar mitzvah is coming up, and he's in a bit of a midlife crisis. Zan, this is the Coens. I've never seen them before.
It's a kind of Trials of Job film, this, isn't it? It's about Larry Gopnik, who is the physics professor who has all kind of petty humiliations meted out onto him, and is casting around for some kind of answer. He wants an audience with the rabbi, but the rabbi is kind of behind closed doors and isn't seeing him, the sense that he is sort of perhaps living in a godless universe. There's the sense as well that he's a physics professor and is about order, but then there's this sort of the chaos of the fates that are just tossing everybody in the air.
I mean, I like that. I like the kind of the certainty, the uncertainty of the certainty that were there, that this world was being shook. Some critics have found this sort of disrespectful. I know some New York critics, New York Jewish critics, have sort of said, well, this is the Coens cocking a snook at their God and at their religion and at their past. I found the completely opposite. I found it warm, affectionate, and kind of interesting that they were saying, well, as a bar mitzvah boy, you get to meet all these rabbis, and you soon learn quickly that there's probably more wisdom in a Jefferson Airplane lyric than there is in the Mishnah.
I agree. I'm surprised that it would be seen as that. I don't think this was disrespectful at all. It's certainly questioning. But that's what you want from the Coens, isn't it?
But that's what to me comic absurd universes do all the time. That's what Kafka did. That's what that's what the best writers do. Mm. And I think that's what some of the characters in the Old Testament did. Job, as you say, even Abraham did the same thing. I thought that this was kind of got to the heart of much of not just this work, but many of their works. In fact, I sort of kind of see it as a bit of a key to unlocking many of the kind of mysteries of the Coens universe.
Perhaps I noticed actually, Jason, that you are on either the poster or the trailer saying that this is their best film ever.
Finest film.
Finest, yes. Film. Why so?
Well, I think that there is a caveat in that quote, but of course it gets lifted totally. There is a caveat. I think it's their finest film, but I think it's handsomely made, and I also think it's their warmest and their funniest, and I think it's their most achieved. I think it sets out to do exactly what it does on the scene. It questions, it kind of mocks, but it also has a great warmth for their character. So I think, for me, it's one of those films that, yes, it has a godless universe, but I think that it has a kind of humanistic kind of faith involved in it, and I think it's kind of up there with Lebowski and Fargo in that kind of affirmation that we're all in this together, and that there is a kind of central philosophy behind some of their work, which I do find lacking in some of the Coens.
I found it colder than you did. I thought it was fascinating. I was never bored by it. I was intrigued by it. I think it's a bit of a bamboozler of a film there. I think it's like a series of brilliant gestures that maybe hint at a profundity that I wasn't entirely in the final analysis sure was there.
But aren't the Coens always slightly embarrassed about being profound?
I think they probably are, but with, say, a film like The Big Lebowski, it doesn't matter, because I find that entirely warm and absurd, and it runs to its own rhythm and drags you along with it, and it's wonderful. This, I felt, was trying for something else but not quite getting there, and I found it finally, I suspected that there was maybe less to it than meets the eye.
Well, I think that it opens with this Yiddish folktale, this sort of shtetl tale, which was rather brilliant, about a dibbuk who's a sort of dead man walking kind of thing, and that sort of says it all in the first 5 minutes. But Yiddish folktales, in fact folktales in general, often do, they kind of sum up and kind of set a mood, and kind of they live on after they have ripples beyond the kind of the punch line, so to speak. And this Coen Brothers film, much like No Country for Old Men, sort of stops without really kind of solving itself.
Yes, and another thing that should be said about this is it's brilliantly acted by a cast of people that you don't normally see in films.
Yeah, I mean, having worked with Brad and George before,
yeah.
Tilda, and obviously Javier and Tommy Lee Jones, I mean, in this one, I don't know anyone.
No, not really. There's Michael Stuhlbarg as Larry Gopnik. There's a great supporting role for a guy called Fred Malamed, playing Cy Abelman? Who's the sort of the obsequious, mellifluous neighbour who steals the main character's wife away, but also wants to offer comfort and to hold him and to hug him.
Larry, it's very important to let a bottle of wine breathe.
and it's just one of the great Coen Brothers supporting characters.
Because he's kind of fat, and I love his golf outfit when he goes in all turquoisey blue, kind of gabardine.
Yeah,
and
this gets all the little details right. It's set in 1967, and it has that sort of hothouse interiors of lots of tan and oranges and yellows.
There's a wonderful scene as well where his next door neighbour, who's this kind of, you know, definite goy with his buzz cut and his son, and they play baseball, throwing all the things that Larry can't do with his kid. And then they come back, they turn the corner one day, and Larry's on the lawn, and they come back, and on their station wagon is this dead moose. It's bleeding with, they've been hunting. It ushers in all that Woody Allen moose sketch.
Yes, and the sense that this is the real America. that the Jewish community of Minneapolis is basically kind of living this semi-detached life, and it can never truly integrate.
Absolutely.
And they're an threatened little enclave.
And I feel like a lost tribe in a way, because what Jews are doing in Minneapolis, I've never known. And I think the Coens themselves, part of their absurdity of their work is from not knowing what on earth they're doing there.
It's the wise outsider's take on an alien culture, and that's what they've been doing for 25 years now.
So A Serious Man, which you found cold, I found warm, but we both kind of have enjoyed. We'll come back to our verdict at it at the end, Zan. But let's move on to another American Jew making a film. Hey, what a surprise. Steven
they get everywhere.
I don't know how we do it. Steven Soderbergh making The Informant, played by Matt Damon as the titular character. Mark here explaining to Agent Shepard why he's going to give the FBI information about the wrongdoing of his company, ADM ASAP.
I'm a biochemist. Yeah, I'm a technical guy. And they pull me into the business side, and suddenly I find out all these things are going on that are illegal. You know, if I want to grow with ADM, I got to learn the business side. And so suddenly I'm lying to people. They're making me lie to people. I lie to you. I mean, I feel real bad about that.
You look at yourself as wearing a white hat and they're wearing black hats?
Yeah, absolutely. Something like that. You know, when I was a kid, my folks died in an automobile accident. I was maybe 6 years old, and a wealthy man from Ohio adopted me. Guy owned amusement parks. He did very well for himself. Now, I caught a big break there, real big break. I went to a good school and all. Now, I adopted two kids of my own. I'm trying to do the right thing here.
Do you think you'd be willing to go a few steps further in helping us?
What does that mean?
Would you be willing to wear a wire?
Matt Damon there in moustache and big belly, putting on weight to play this informant, this kind of whistleblower, this slippery snake within the American corporate system. This is Steven Soderbergh at his, I thought was going to be at his most playful, but it turns out rather different.
Well, I think he maybe started out trying to be playful. This is a subverted whistleblower thriller in which the whistle turns out to be a raspberry. in that Mark Whittaker, Matt Damon character, is an executive at this anonymous company that seems to just trade in corn products. And he's aware of this price-fixing scam, so he starts walking around with a wiretap and gets very excited by all of this, thinks he's James Bond, other times thinks he's Tom Cruise out of the firm.
The firm, he's obsessed with that.
And you gradually realise that he's delusional, he's a blabbermouth, he's a pathological liar. And it disrobes him, I guess, by degrees. You start out thinking he is a trustworthy character, and then he's not. In doing so, I found the film increasingly less trustworthy as well.
I did as well. I mean, it starts The Informant, it's got an exclamation mark, and it's kind of
that's
done in all
a
that
bad sign, isn't it?
It is normally
you
a bad
you should shout
sign.
That title.
But obviously Soderbergh knows what he's doing, is my thing. I mean, this is an artist who kind of is very restless and has loads of different things, and he does caper movies, and he's done sort of schizoid things before with an early film called Schizopolis. I find him a sort of very interesting person to watch. And I thought this film was, I don't know what, maybe I've been misled by this film, because I thought it was going to be something else that it wasn't from its jazzy little Marvin Hamlish score and the kind of caperish kind of tone. And then it became sort of much darker and much more plodding. And I thought it got lost in its tone. But maybe, as you're even explaining it to me there again, I'm thinking, well, maybe it's something cleverer than that at play. But I thought it was very dully made.
I didn't like this at all, really. I think that Soderbergh is almost too clever for this kind of movie, in that he's made Erin Brockovich, so he's made the corporate thriller, and now he's setting out to make a kind of anti-Erin Brockovich, so he's subverting it. But he subverts it and then doesn't know quite where he wants to go with it.
Yeah, that's what I felt.
And it's like he's bored of Erin Brockovich, but then he's bored of this as well.
Yeah.
And the film just goes in sort of ever-decreasing circles.
I sort of feel like with him, you know, he makes about 3 films a year and shoots them and writes them, and is Peter Andrews, his own cinematographer. I thought he sort of had a good idea here and went halfway through, you know, sod it, I'm going to go off and make The Girlfriend Experience, which is out next week.
Right.
So I just think
he's too prolific for his own good, maybe.
And I thought it needed some harder work. I mean, Marvin Hamlish, who I think is a wonderful scorer, hasn't made a score since 1996, and he persuaded him out of retirement to make the score for this. And I think, well, if you've got Marvin Hamlish that doing this kind of 1960s Henry Mancini kind of thing, you should use it. And they sort of use it, but it doesn't actually match the action at all.
I thought they used it too much. I found it actually very intrusive and annoying.
But if it was nudging you in the ribs. But if the action was comedy or caperish, then it perhaps would have gone with it if it was an Oceans thing. But it isn't.
No, it's not.
Let's leave The Informant. That's quite enough information on that one. Let's move to New Moon. Let's get young, Zan. Let's take our tops off and be buff vampires or werewolves. This is New Moon, the sequel to Twilight, the second in a trilogy based on Stephanie Meyer's novels. Kristen Stewart is the high school heroine in love with a vampire who's left town, but she has a new protector called Jake.
Hey, what did you do to him?
Watch it, girl.
He didn't want this.
What did we do? What did he do? What did he tell you?
Both of you, calm down.
Nothing. He tells me nothing because he's scared of you.
Paul, don't.
Too late now.
Bella, get back. Paul. Paul, get back now.
Ah, bring back Michael Jackson and Thriller, I say, Zan. New Moon, are you partial to the teenage vampires?
Who couldn't be partial to teenage vampires? We were all teenage vampires once, but here there's a new boy in town who turns out to be a werewolf. Jake is not all that he seems.
Are we spoiling things by saying he's a werewolf?
No, we're not.
Because I saw it about of the first when he came on, I went, well, he looks a bit like a werewolf, that boy.
Did you think
his eyebrows are a bit close together?
Was there another kid in there that you thought looked a bit like Frankenstein?
Yeah, there was another kid who looked like a zombie.
For the next film.
But maybe that was the critic sitting next to me.
Right. But to date a vampire in the first movie, maybe that's careless. But to date, a werewolf in the second one, she's got a death wish.
She really has. But isn't she like most teenage girls that they just go for the wrong'un?
Go for the bad boy. I think maybe they do. And actually, she's probably the best thing in these films.
Isn't she? I think she's really good.
Kristen Stewart is really good. I liked her in Adventureland earlier this year as well. And she's great at playing these slightly moping, solipsistic, self-absorbed teenagers. And she does it really well. And she is the moral centre to basically a pretty stupid movie.
She does it in a way that I don't hate her.
Absolutely.
Which normally I do hate teenagers like that.
Yeah.
I did when I was a teenager.
I did.
But Robert Pattinson is one of those teenagers, and he's the kind of huge sensation. He's the kind of guy with his top off. Everyone loves Robert Pattinson. He just looks white and I never get those kind of, you know, Morrissey kind of teenager people.
Just because you weren't one yourself.
No, and because I'm not as buff as Robert Pattinson. Everyone in this film is buff. My God, the boys. Well, I know. I mean, when I was 16, I've never looked like any of these people.
They look like werewolf Chippendales, don't they? and you see a lot of them. And I guess this is one of the USPs of this film. Certainly, they have to find something to replace Robert Pattinson, who's barely in this
at all.
Yeah,
I know. I was like, oh, I'm going to check out the Robert Pattinson thing. And he's like, he's only in it for five
minutes. He's gone, and he keeps kind of popping back as a hologram.
Yeah, he's like Laurence Olivier in that Time musical.
Yes, yeah, he is, yeah, yeah. And just as classy.
there's lots of music as well as the number one album made by loads of dreary indie bands, like Tom York and Muse and all that. They kind of pepper the soundtrack. I mean, last week we had Panic! White Ribbon, which doesn't have a single note of music to go with it. This one doesn't have a single bit of silence. Everything is kind of underscored by twangly guitars. I did think it was rather beautiful, though. I love the setting. I think it's sort of Portland. Is it Portland, Oregon?
No, I think it's Washington State.
Right.
It's Pacific Northwest, and it has that misty, drizzly, verdant feel.
Yeah, captured by cameraman Javier Aguirre Sarobi, who a Spanish cameraman.
Do the teenage girls like him too?
I think they probably do, actually. There's a nice little bit with another actress who's in the new George Clooney film, Up in the Air, where they go and see a zombie movie called Dead Men Eat something, and they come out and they have a little chat, and then she goes, oh, zombie movies, there's never any hot guys in it. What's the thing with zombie movies? I mean, I know there is critique of consumerism, and they kind of critique the whole kind of vampire, zombie, werewolf
thing.
They do.
That's one of the few knowing asides, and it was actually very welcome, because otherwise these films are, they play it very straight. It's incredibly po-faced, and I guess there's something admirable about that. It's definitely playing to the audience of slightly angsty, solipsistic teenagers.
Absolutely.
And it's not making fun of them at all. It's not being knowing. But there's maybe just a few glimmers of that in this one, which lightens it a little.
Absolutely. And I thought sort of after Jennifer's Body, which was Diablo Cody's take on this kind of genre where everyone's really smart-mouthed and clever in high school, I didn't recognise any girls in this. Actually, I thought that serious take on... There's a wonderful, lovely moment where she's pining for her lost vampire. And she's just in her room.
And the camera
circles her, and it goes December, January, and she's in this kind of teenage funk of kind of blackness, and I thought that was really beautifully
done.
It
captured my own teenage years when I was pining for vampires.
Did you ever find yours?
No, I'm still looking.
Oh, Zan.
She's still out there somewhere.
I hope it's not the redhead in this one. She's vicious, that Victoria. So, New Moon, which I thought sort of does what it says on the tin in my own way. So let's have a little look at the films we've got this week. So A Serious Man from the Coens. How many stars are you going to give that?
I'm going to give that 4 stars, I think. I didn't love it as much as I wanted to, and I was desperately trying to, but I still think it's a fascinating piece of work.
Yeah, I'm going to give it 5 stars. The final one of those is Star of David, so it's an extra Jewish star.
Oh, well, then you've
star.
Got, yeah, that, then you've got the jump on me with that last
so
star.
So I'm allowed to
I'm not
that.
A member of
you
your tribe.
You can't give that one, though. The Informant! By Steven Soderbergh, starring Matt Damon.
That too, and maybe that's being generous. 2 stars.
Yeah, it wore me down. I'm going to go 2 as well, only because 1, it's probably a bit better than 1, but, you know, I didn't get it. Our producer, Jason Phipps, he really liked the film. He thought it was kind of spry and really got all the mystery in there at all. But anyway, he's not reviewing today. And New Moon, Zan, Teenage Werewolves.
This was better than The Informant. But I think I'm still going to give it 2.
Yeah, I sort of was slightly converted into it by the way. So I'm going to go give it 3 stars, just basically so that teenage girls will love me more than they love you.
Okay, well, I think that was already a given.
Zan, lovely to see you. Thanks for that. But does make A Serious Man the film of the week, the film of the month.
Oh, deservedly.
Yeah, absolutely. The Coens beat the werewolves, and they'll be very pleased with that, because I can't see them holding up a cross to any vampires. You can read a full list of reviews and Zan's musings about film at guardian.co.uk/film. Not only will you find the latest and best reviews and news on the Guardian website, you'll also find this.
I think sexuality, growing up as a Chinese person, it's something very much in the mind, like everybody in the world, but we don't have much communication. And as a dramatist, I just like that awkwardness.
Yes, the Oscar-winning director Ang Lee reveals all in my In the Director's Chair video series. To watch the whole interview in glorious Technicolor, all you've got to do is go to guardian.co.uk In the Director's Chair. Mainstream cinema seems increasingly aimed at the young these days, so that even the old are taking their inner child to the cinema with them. But there is a refreshing antidote to all this, a place that treats children cinema goers like adults. So it's with this in mind that I'm joined by 2 special guests from the 5th London Children's Film Festival, which kicks off this weekend. Robert Ryder is a programmer at the Barbican, and he's joined by one of the 6 young festival ambassadors, Jubi Hossain from Redbridge. Welcome to Film Weekly.
Thank you.
How lovely to see you, particularly you, Jubi, who I think are the youngest guests we've ever had on Film Weekly. How old are you?
I'm 13 years old.
13 years old, and you love cinema?
Yeah.
What's your favourite film, Jubi?
We watched a film called The Crocodiles, and yeah, I really like that film.
Oh, what's that about?
It's about this like gang of a couple of people who call themselves The Crocodile. They're sort of gang in the neighbourhood, and they're always getting up to mischievous things.
Yeah, they're little adventurers, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a whole gang, and there's a girl in that gang, isn't there?
Yeah.
Boys don't really let girls in gangs. But no, they get up to all sorts of mischief, don't they? But I mean, I haven't seen this one, but it seems to be the one that everyone is talking about. All the young ambassadors say that The Crocodiles is their favourite film. Robert, you program the London Children's Film Festival. I mean, you also program all the other kind of highbrow stuff at the Barbican as well, you know, that is part of a wonderful year's program. Yeah. Is this a sort of fun kind of exercise as well? Because it seems to me that the filmmaking on display here is just as skilled as all the other filmmaking.
You know, after I wouldn't exactly call it the highbrow stuff, but the regular programming that we do, which is mainly for an adult audience, this stuff definitely feels like a fun side, and it's just a great festival to be involved with. Now we're into the 5th year, and I think we've got one of the strongest programs we've ever had.
Yeah, let's have a little look at that program, because it starts off with Ponyo. Which is a film I haven't seen by Miyazaki, who is just extraordinary. Did Spirited Away? Did Howl's Moving Castle? I suppose
Princess Mononoke.
Well, yeah, one of the great filmmakers in any genre of all time. I suppose
we're absolutely thrilled to have Ponyo on the Cliff as the opening film, and because he's such a highly regarded director, and his films have children right at the heart. And I suppose that also reflects, you know, what, as Jabir says, what the festival's about. Because when we first started the festival, at the opening events, we'd have VIPs and dignitaries and grown-ups talking about children's festival, and then a children's film festival. And then we thought to ourselves, why are we doing it this way, in this stodgy way? We need children to be at the heart of the children's festival. So now, if you come to the gala on Saturday morning, Saturday the 21st, you'll find it's not the VIPs who are opening the festival. It's Jabir and the other young patrons and young ambassadors who will be interviewing the VIPs and the grown-ups.
Wow. So you get to be a journalist?
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
Yeah. So do you know who you're going to be meeting? Do you know what you're going to be asking them?
No, but we know the sort of feel of the Q&A because we've done lots more before.
Have you done lots of Q&As?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's really good.
How much do you charge? Good rates, I bet. Damn, it's a good job. Robert, do you find that there's a nation in particular that is particularly gifted at, say, children's films, for example? We mentioned Japan there.
Yes, yeah. Within Europe, there's the Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and then Germany and the Netherlands. Those five countries, they're countries who they put state funding into the production of children's films. And as Jabir says, you know, that he's had a chance to see quite a few foreign films, often films with subtitles. And we did some research at the Barbican recently about the number of films, children's films, which had been released in any one year. And so, for example, last year, there were over 550 films released in the UK, of which only 20 were children's films, and that's using it in the children's films in the widest, you know, sense, of which 17 came from Hollywood, came from the States. Mm. So, you know, basically children in the UK are being denied the opportunity to see the rich, the wealth of children's films that are being produced around the world. They just don't come to this country. So that's what the Children's Film Festival, the London Children's Film Festival, is about.
And what can we see? I mean, I know it's almost a cliche to kind of say, well, Hollywood is, you know, it produces films so they can make games, so they can make video games, figurines, and sell adverts and cereal boxes too.
Yes.
Presumably, the stuff that they do in Netherlands and Germany doesn't quite have all that commercial tie in, doesn't have all that baggage.
No, not to the same extent.
Yeah, like when you watch a film, when you watch a foreign film, you can see, like, compared to here, it's like you've got all these different things following on after, like, you know, things that go, like, for example, High School Musical, that when that came out, there were, like, lots of things coming out after, like, lots of these dolls and that. And that when you see these films, like, oh, yeah, that's really good, but...
Yeah, so, you don't need all that.
No.
Yeah.
The film's great itself.
Yeah, you don't want to cheapen it with, you know, playing... Have you got High School Musical dolls?
No,
exactly. That you just don't look like a man who would have such things. Good ambassador work there, Jabir Hussain. Thank you so much for coming on. Lovely to meet you.
Yeah,
you'll be sitting in this seat soon, I shouldn't wonder, if you keep your Q&A skills up. Enjoy the festival. Enjoy being an ambassador. I think you've done a very good job so far. And the festival hasn't even started yet. So lovely to meet you, Jabir Hussain. Robert Ryder, programmer from the London Children's Film Festival at the Barbican. Thank you so much for coming on Film Weekly, both
Jason.
Of you.
Thank you.
And for more information on the London Children's Film Festival at the Barbican, go to barbican.org.uk or their special dedicated website, lcff.org.uk. That brings an end to this Film Weekly. The music featured in the podcast this week is from Glorious 39 by composer Adrian Johnston. Do remember to pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my trailer trash column and all the best reviews. And the year, may I remind you, is fast drawing to a close. Myself and Zan Brooks will, of course, be rounding up a top 10 of 2009, but we're really keen to hear what your best film released this year might be. So please let us know. You can do it on our blog comments page. You can go to Facebook, Film Weekly Fans, that's us, or you can email the old address, film.weekly@guardian.co.uk. But for this week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.